Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces Podcast, episode 173, and I'm joined this week by Russell Howard, which is a very exciting one. I've been wanting to have Russell on for a little while. I mentioned it all in the podcast, so I won't go deeply into it, but his show was the first show I heard some of my music played on TV, or one of the first that wasn't like MTV or something like that. He also plays one of my songs before his show, and my kind of sister-in-law, kind of my dad's long-term girlfriend's daughter, they're not married, so not technically a sister-in-law, but you don't need that information, was watching him in Australia and sent a video like, this is really weird. I'm in a massive venue about to watch some comedy and Pip's playing through the speakers. So that's lovely. Before we get into that, thank you all very much for last week's love. I had Michael Fassbender on. It was a bit of a surprise for you guys. I like to keep them quiet until I've actually recorded them. I've got one I'm recording this week that I'm really excited about. That'll actually be, I think it'll be next week's episode. But until I've recorded it, I'm not going to tell you. I watched the film it's relating to yesterday. I met the writer and director. But the podcast I'm recording in a day or two, so I'm not going to tell you yet. But it's a good one. It's another good one, and the film is fantastic, so that's exciting. Yeah, but got a lot of love for Michael Fassbender. That was insane reaction, so thank you all for that one. I posted about it quite a bit because I was quite excited, but hopefully you can forgive me for that. Speaking of posting quite a bit, the podcast is brought to you as ever by SpeechDevelopmentRecords.com, and we just launched our Dark Winter range with an amazing photo shoot by B-Dux Photography, at B-Dux Photography on Instagram. And we've released sweaters and jackets and bobble hats. Now, all three of them were available in one form or another, but we've either stocked up or made slight changes. But the new things we've released are scarves that have the slogan, the Distraction Pieces slogan of, not Distraction Pieces, the Speech Development slogan of, we may not be for you and that's fine, on these scarves that look amazing. We've released rucksacks, which look fantastic. Again, with that slogan and a little rubber emblem of the Speech Development rat designed by Mr. Heggie. And we've released umbrellas, which is the one that I'm most excited about because they look so awesome. It's just a black umbrella with that big striking, again, the logo of we may not be for you and that's fine on top of it. It looks wicked. So they're all available at SpeechDevelopmentRecords.com. Check them out. Christmas is coming. So there's two reasons I mention that. Number one, it'd be good for you to get these as presents for people or put them on your Christmas list. And number two, it'd be good for you to put money in my pocket so that I can buy people Christmas presents. So it's win-win, really, and it's like a double. It's like when you click that button to say that your tax your VAT registered or something, or tax registered, and you want to do that extra donation thing. What's that? I've described that really badly. It's that thing like when you say, do you want to, you donate, oh, I can't remember, it's a tick box. Oh, this is useless. Anyway, I should also mention, a lot of you are fans of the Drunk Cast and have been asking if we're going to be doing another Christmas Drunk Cast. The good news is, we did a live Drunk Cast and it came out last week, but I didn't put it here. I put it on the Hardcore Listing podcast channel. So scoot over there and you'll get a three-part live Drunk Cast in Dublin. With me, Chris and Stu getting hammered on stage. It gets really messy. Messy to the extent that Chris decided he didn't have time to leave the stage to go to the toilet. Yeah, I'm not going to say a lot more than that, but I'll leave you to investigate that. We're still probably going to do some kind of end of year Drunk Cast, maybe, but it depends who's about and when we can do it and stuff like that. But yeah, I've got loads of good guests coming up. Let me have a look at my list and see who I can actually announce and tell you about. Just get my list up now. So I can tell you about a Russell Howard, which is today. I can tell you about S. Craig Zahler, who's in out on November 1st. Now, he's the director of Bone Tomahawk and the amazing new Vince Vaughn film, Brawl in Cell Block 99. It's one of my films of the year, easily. It's absolutely fantastic. You're going to love that. Then I've got the Dublin podcast festival live Distraction Pieces two-parter, where I was joined by Blind Boy from Rubber Bandits and the audience. So that's coming up. I've got Gene Grey coming up. I've got Johnny Lee Miller coming up. Let me tell you three that... Oh, no, I don't want to tease any. No, I'm going to leave it. I've got some really good ones coming up. Just take my word. We are ending the year impossibly strong. If you look in this second half of the year where we've had people like Alice Lowe, who's amazing, Ashlyn B, I don't know why I always try and pronounce it Bay, Will Poulter, who was in the amazing Detroit, Eddie Izzard, Suad McKennitt, Helen Chamberlain, Michael Fassbender, Russell Howard, all these ones that are ahead. Good Lord, we're ending strong this year. And I've actually confirmed one to start next year. I was meant to be recording it this week, and it's been moved, so hopefully I'm going to record it in January, but it's a really good one. So, and also, I spoke to Jim Norton, who's over in December, and we were saying about him coming on the podcast, so maybe I'll record that in December and put that out in the new year. Feel free to nudge him on social media and tell him how much you'd love to hear him on the Distraction Pieces podcast. I think Jim Norton is an absolute legend, and I want to tell him so. Yeah, I'll get on with this podcast. It was great to talk to Russell. He invited me into his home and was an absolute delight. So, yeah, this is episode 173 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with Russell Howard. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. Right, I'm joined today by Russell Howard. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm good. It's nice to be here and have a chat. We've chatted on social media a little bit over the years.
We had a little natter. Yeah.
So it's good to...
They're playing one of your songs before a gig of mine in Australia.
Yes. And my kind of sister-in-law was at that gig.
Oh, right.
And was like, this is weird. I wasn't expecting to hear this.
What a song.
A letter from man to God. Yes. Brilliant. Thank you very much. And also, your show, it was in the first series, I think, of Good News, was the first time I'd ever just been watching a show because I'm a fan.
Yes.
And one of my songs came on.
Oh, really?
Because you had Great Britain as one of the segue things.
Yes.
Which was one of our tracks. And that was like...
Well, this is what happens.
I'm a successful musician now.
If you're going to make good stuff, mate, people are going to use it.
It's going to sneak
How
on
did
there.
You come up with that song? What was the... Because I love it. I love it when somebody cuts. It's such a great concept. It's a brilliant. Yeah. It's so simple.
But I love this. I love the nature of and the etymology, I guess, of ideas. Because that literally came. I was at a spoken word gig.
Yeah.
And someone did a piece, and I couldn't tell if they'd said creator or curator.
Right. And that was where
it all stemmed from. That I drove home and wrote the bulk of it on the drive home, just saying it out loud and got home and had to type it up because it was purely that. I was like, creator, curator. So if God was to speak on his thing, would he feel that, I made all this, or I kind of put it together a bit. I feel people over credit me.
Yeah.
You know,
I love it. Sometimes that happens from a spelling mistake as well. Like, it's amazing how close scared and sacred are.
Yeah.
Because I was writing the other day, we're all so scared. And I wrote, we're all so sacred.
Yeah.
And then you kind of go, ah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And we were kind of, I was just talking with my mate about it, and we're having one of those kind of conversations.
Yeah.
It's really interesting, isn't it, how close those two are?
Yeah. And there's
it's really funny how little ideas just come from I don't know if it's the same with, because I'm obsessed with how people come up with songs.
Yeah.
Because I know from comedy that ideas will just go, whoosh.
Yeah.
You know, I remember seeing ages ago, I was driving through London, and this bloke put a bollard on a bus stop. And there was a joke I did ages ago, and it was just about a drunk man and the mindset of a drunk bloke thinking that bus stop needs a hat.
Yeah.
And it was just a little, you know, it just invited itself into my life, and you're like, oh, that'll do. And other times you just sit there in front of a laptop or with a notepad just crunching over a story and trying to find, and it takes ages and ages and ages. Yeah. And sometimes they just arrive fully formed.
I think it's kind
like
of
little messes.
Yeah.
Like, do you know what I mean?
But I think that's the thing that gives a lot of artists the imposter syndrome,
right?
Because you have certain ideas that just you feel you've not really come up with them.
Yeah.
You saw a bollard that now I've got to write a new hour.
Yes.
Am I capable of this? Because I fluked that last. Like, I saw a few things and this happened. And it's not until you get a bit into your career, it's like, no,
I see them because of the way I look at things and because of my ability. It's not just this chance thing that I've seen that and written a song or written a joke.
Yeah.
It's kind of having that confidence to go, I'll see more weird stuff and, figure out what's funny about it.
It's kind of that thing of putting yourself in danger, isn't it? Or just putting yourself in a different area and reading about different things, I think.
Yeah. It's an important thing as you progress in your
career.
Or getting
into different music. Music was a big thing for me. So I really got into Kendrick Lamar during the last tour that I did. And it was the first time I'd ever listened to him. And I just thought it was a really nice mix of social commentary and knob gags.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you kind of go, oh, it's really interesting that he's talking about these things through rap.
Yeah,
and
completely.
not to be too wanky, but I thought, oh, I could probably do, like, I had this big bit in my tour which was about 1 in 4 16 to 25 year old girls in the UK self-harm, and I was sort of this huge bit about that, about why do they do it and trying to figure it out, and that was sort of a 15 minute bit, and I was doing it in kind of arenas, and before that I wouldn't have ever had the kind of balls to think, oh, you can chat about that. But when you listen to like a rap album and he's talking about very heavy stuff through a rap song, you think, you can.
I think Kendrick is hugely misunderstood by those who don't listen to him for exactly that. His big song that has just got the hook of drank and all that kind of thing, it sounds like it's just a party song. It's like, no, it's a song about alcohol addiction and the danger of it and the power of it. It's like, and that was a massive pop hit.
Yeah.
Well, it's wonderful is that?
It's like Born in the USA.
Yeah.
Like the completely. Old, it's just so funny, isn't it?
It's
like
the old one.
No one's ever listened to the verse.
No. But it was weird when I think it was Reagan started to use it in one of his campaign.
That's right.
Things,
yeah.
It's like, it's the opposite of the gay community or the black community taking a phrase back and making it their own. It's like, we're taking that song back. It's like, you've written that against us and we're just going to sing the middle bit and go, born in the year. It's like, no, it's not about that. It's horrible. But yeah, it's an interesting one. And it's important. It excites me to hear that you're discussing things like that in big arena tour type shows, because I do think when you've got... A lot of people don't realise that when they get... That audience, yes, they have to please them, but equally, you've got their ear,
you've
got the ability more than anyone to broach these tough subjects. Because if it's someone they've never heard of, or your opener, or whoever else, then they might be a bit. Whereas if they're already on board with you, then you've got that.
Well, it was interesting. I was talking about. I found out about it and I spoke to my friend Roisin Conaty about it and I spoke to my girlfriend about it and I spoke to my dad about it and my brother and my sister and I just kept on, you know, something just won't leave your head and you're just telling people, it's fucking mental, why is this happening? And then you sort of eventually go, you've got to just try talking it out on stage. And then I had a really interesting chat with, like, Tim Minchin put it brilliantly, and not to sound too far up my own arse, but this is kind of how he phrased it. He was like, you can kind of talk about anything because you spent 15 years being a comedian.
Yeah.
You can't help but be funny.
Yeah.
Because if you're in front of an audience and you're talking about something, you feel, if you're being too heavy, you feel where the gaps are. So you feel like there's nothing quite like an audience to make you funny.
Yeah.
There's a really good thing to think of, that if you've been doing it for long enough, you can go wherever you want and the audience will go with you, because, you know, you see like Barack Obama doing speeches in front of 40,000 people, or you know, Trump in an entirely different way, but there's huge audiences there, so you can say whatever you want. But I think we get into this weird sort of idea, particularly with arenas, like, oh, it can only be men and women stuff or airline stuff or very kind of basic stuff. But everyone is interested in new facts and new stories, and everyone hears that 1 in 4 16 to 25 year old women self-harm with a sense of, what? Fuck?
Yeah.
And if you're a normal bloke, so if, like, my dad was going to watch me 30 years ago, he'd have heard that, and he probably would have had a chat with my sister.
Yeah.
Just because you kind of take that and you go, are you all right? Is everything? I mean, it wouldn't have been a very full-on chat. He would have gone, you're not doing anything daft. And my sister would have gone, no, good, right, see you at Christmas. Yeah, but, like, do you know what I mean? I think, I don't know, I think it's really, whatever you give a shit about, you should try and talk about.
Yeah.
And I think it's a lot easier to be funny about it than, like, it kind of, the similar thing with the Sky show we're doing in a minute, it's really difficult initially it was kind of, they said, do you want to do like a chat show? And I was like, yeah, maybe, see how that is. And you quickly realise, like, the idea, there's a real skill in being able to go, right, let's play swing ball with Little Mix. Let's throw tea bags at Simon Cowell and see how many he can catch his mouth, and coming up with those completely inconsequential yeah. bits of fluffy daftness.
Yeah.
But they're so hard. Yeah. Whereas if you're talking about, like, I don't know, food hunger or what you think about the police or the housing situation in the UK, yeah. it's stuff that you actually care about.
Yeah.
And it's a lot easier to be interesting or funny about something like that rather than going, or this is me personally, living kind of, I'm not very good at kind of getting annoyed about small things.
Yeah.
I just let him go.
Yeah.
Like me
yeah.
and John Richardson, when we lived together, it was so perfect because John's so funny about like about and he'd be like, oh, fucking hell, who's left the Rice Krispies on the side? And yeah. I was like, hey, fucking leave them, man, they're Rice Krispies. So we had this perfect kind of relationship.
Yeah.
But I've never been able to get irked by small stuff.
I love it. I think it's important though. And the new show, which is the Russell Howard Hour,
yeah.
correct? Is,
yeah,
is
cure.
I think it's.
I wanted to call it Woe and Wonder, but it had to have my name in it. So
I mean, that. Is that something that's in your contracts? Because every show you've ever done,
yeah, no. The worst I had, I did a show with my mum. It's like the Russell Howard. What was he even called? It was like Russell Howard's travels with his mum in America.
Yep,
it was like the
yep.
most literal.
Is,
show.
Is it because of the needing clarity because of being one of the funny Russells?
Probably, yeah.
Because there's you, there's Brandon, there's Kane. You need that name in there to go, it's this Russell. It's like it's like the sexy Ryans. So there's Ryan Reynolds, Ryan Gosling, yes. and Ryan Phillippe. Yeah. It's similar with the Russells. There's yes. all of these came up around the same time. So it's important to have that in there to go, it's this Russell.
Yeah,
it's not one of the other two Russells.
Exactly.
I don't want them taking the credit.
Least sexy Russell. That's what it should be.
Yeah.
There's a real sliding scale of hot. He kind of got, it's weird because he goes from like rock star to boy band.
Yeah.
Like, do you know what I mean? You got Russell looking all swarthy, and then Russell Kane's in the middle, and then.
But it's better to be on the end than in the middle because you get to be 2013 Weird Crush.
Oh,
was
oh,
it
right.
was it 2013?
Yeah, yeah.
It's yeah. just again, it's great that John Richardson, because again, you said him getting annoyed about the small things.
Yes.
Him being number two would have been that one thing that makes him go.
He was furious. Yeah.
Unbelievable. Yeah, what's yeah. going on?
Well, the thing is, this year as well, like, I only find out about it because people shout out gigs, but I was like number 17 and I was beaten by Hodor from Game of Thrones. He was just
amazing.
Before me, which, you know, can only say one fucking word.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
he can only say his own name. I got beat by him and Piers Morgan. It says a lot about.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Kind of
God,
fascinating.
That's painful. But anyway, onto the show.
It
was hugely exciting to watch the first two episodes, because in America they've got a Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, which I think is amazing, and I think has done really good for addressing serious issues in an amusing manner, in an entertaining manner. And this, I've felt for a long time the UK needs something like that, but you can't just do a straight copy of it.
Yes.
And it's what I liked about this show was it allows you to talk about these huge issues. And then there's the space in it to do a load of other stuff, to talk to guests, to have different sections. And
yeah.
how is that, to kind of have that pressure of... Because there's not really many shows that are talking about the big issues in an amusing or engaging manner, in a mainstream manner, I guess. Because I do feel it has. It's got that mainstream appeal.
Absolutely. And it's really funny, isn't it? The mainstream, the word mainstream has a real... There's a real problem with it. People get really upset, but yeah. I'm an unashamedly mainstream comic.
Yeah.
But what I've learned is that, like I said, you can talk about these. You can talk about big things and serious things, and people are interested. I think the problem is when you have like a big mainstream audience, it's kind of a waste to just feed them up stuff that they've heard before. So I could go on there and do a load of stories about my family, and they're all fine. But it's far better to kind of mix it all up. So you've got a funny story about my family intertwined with, like, we're doing a bit next week about the sort of the relationship between blue and pink, about buying blue and pink clothes for kids.
Yeah.
And we've kind of done loads of research. So you can buy like a boy's laptop, which has a toy laptop for boys. Yeah. It has 50 functions, but the girl's one has 25.
Right, that's
and it's a blue, it's a blue laptop, and it's a pink laptop,
yeah.
And it's and then there's, you know, little thing, there's clothes that say junior doctor, and there's clothes they're in blue, and what ones that say little nurse. So, and I think that is an area instantly. It's really fascinating. You kind of go, okay, well, why do we do that?
Yeah.
And as a comedian, you think, God, there's such. That's my dog. That's my dog.
He's furious about the issues.
Yeah, exactly. Arch, let it go. See, this is like, it's like I'm still living with John.
Fucking hell.
But yeah, so I, the short answer is I really enjoy it because, you know, we have a big audience every week.
Yeah.
And they're really enjoying it. They're really tuned into it. I've done all my research. Everything's been fact-checked. So if I talk about the fact that 309 Tory MPs voted against making a house fit for human habitation, they did. And there's comedy in that to kind of go, you're voting against a thing being a thing.
Yeah.
So it's about unpicking things that have happened and then putting a sort of a spin on them.
Yeah.
Like we did it this week with the shooting in Vegas.
Right.
I just found it phenomenal that you have Trump, A, not calling him a terrorist, and B, the first thing he did was kind of basically going, you know, I pray for you and hopefully God will, like, I've, you know, we speak to God for you. I don't know exactly what he said, but it was along those lines.
Yeah.
And it just struck me as that's fucking phenomenal that you kind of, that there is no magic man. Like, you're the magic man. You're the president of the United States. So don't speak to God. Speak to the gun lobby. Try and change the world rather than going, well, there's our thoughts and prayers. And it just struck me that prayers... It's always that phrase, isn't it? That
it's such a get-out, isn't it? It's a get-out it's I don't want to do anything, but I'll pray.
But I'll pray for you. And
well, don't.
Yeah, exactly. Because
right, just didn't.
Well, guns don't kill people. People do. Yeah, it's the phrase we hear.
Yeah.
But prayers don't help people. People do.
Yeah.
And that's what we—that's what I said on the show. And it's not funny, but it resonates, and it's an eloquent way of saying what we're all thinking.
Yeah.
So I love the fact that I can do a show where, you know, I don't have to be funny. I can just be indignant, or I can be positive, or I can be angry, or I can be funny. It can be anything, because over the hour, it's fine. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Whereas if you were just doing, like you say, if you're doing like a half an hour show,
100%,
you kind of have to.
Yeah. Oh, right. That's it. It feels, the thing I really enjoyed was it felt like, number one, you've got the space to really get into issues properly. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be this is our fourth section, so we need to wrap this theme up in 5 minutes or whatever else. And also, I don't know if it's, and again, this isn't against the BBC in any way. I love the BBC, but when I've worked with them in the past, there are certain restrictions because it's a public service. So it felt the freedom to get angrier.
Oh yeah,
all definitely. Of a sudden to go, no, this is fucking outrageous. This isn't acceptable. Rather than, isn't this a bit rubbish? It's like, no, this is appalling.
Yeah,
you know, and that's what excited me on this, because it's got. I mean, let's be blunt. It's got elements of the previous shows that you've done. It's got the what I loved about. Russell Howard's Good News was that it was addressing things in the news. It was showing funny clips, which again, we speak of mainstream.
Yeah.
Mainstream is mainstream for a reason.
Yeah.
Like, funny clips are good.
Yeah.
There shouldn't be any shame about that. Absolutely. About, oh, that's not very highbrow. It's like, no, but it's an adorable goat. You know,
yeah, absolutely. But it's that thing. I think it's about mixing it all together.
Yeah.
And never, so like, we'd never just kind of like, show a clip for the sake of it.
No.
But if something fit, then it kind of makes sense. And why not give people a spoonful of sugar?
100%. Yeah. 100%. And it really, it makes the harder issues go down easier. But also, it highlights that impact. When I was watching last night, which weirdly, in the advert break, there was an advert for the new Kinder Eggs that come, a pink version and a blue version.
Oh, really?
Well, there you go. That's topical for next week's, if they're still sponsoring. But what struck me was exactly that I'm laughing along, and then bang, I'm hit with a statistic or a fact or even just a view or opinion. And I really enjoyed the piece on police.
Yeah.
Because I have a propensity at times to lean against the police, against the actions, because of so much going on in America and in the UK.
Yeah.
And I thought it was beautifully put, kind of, it wasn't shying away from the negativity from police, but it was highlighting that we're all responsible for a lot of.
That's the key thing I wanted to do. Well, that because that's the thing that blew my mind, that you can look into the cuts that Theresa May's made since she was Home Secretary and now Prime Minister, and the fact they've got to make £3 billion worth of saving by 2020.
Yeah.
But, which is shocking, and, you know, we see, like, you know, awful terror attacks and acid attacks and all this kind of crazy shit. And we're like, we need more police. But then when you look into it, that over half of police time is spent with us when we're pissed.
Yeah.
I think it's really interesting that you kind of go, like, God, we've got a really weird relationship with boots, and there's comedy in that, and it also makes you think, because we've all got mates that have got shit-faced and done something daft, or we've all got pissed and done something stupid, and you sort of think, God, if we all took a bit more responsibility. But I don't know, it was because I was gigging in Europe this year, and I was in Stockholm and Copenhagen, and I was travelling around Norway, and then I eventually got to Amsterdam, and I'd had 3 weeks away from English people. And then I was in Amsterdam, and there was like Spanish people and Italians and Germans and Dutch. And the only people that were shit-faced was us.
Yeah.
Like, it was the English. It was like the stag and hen dudes. And it was that thing of going, God, not in a critical way, but like, we deal with booze differently.
Yeah.
Like us and the Russians. There is that sense of, you know, get it down here. Like when you're a kid, you're taught to drink. Go on. Go on, get it down, yeah.
Completely.
You know, I think that would be an interesting thing to talk about. You know?
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, I my relationship with alcohol has changed hugely in the last 5 years or so, because I've grown up in Essex. So again, I'm used to, you go out and you drink, and you drink to get drunk. That's the default. That's the point of it. And it
we drink until, before we go out to drink.
Exactly. Yeah. Again, I come from Essex, and I don't come from wealth. So we drink before we go out to make it affordable, and then just top up. Just try and keep at that level.
Yeah.
But I was going out with a girl who was teetotal, and she was fine with me drinking around her. But it meant that every time I was out, I had to think if I want to drink or not, which sounds weird, but I'd never done that before.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought, do I want to drink? I just drank. And it means I now drink once or twice a month, if that. There's been a few times I've realised I've done a dry month and not even thought to be sponsored for the honour. But it's mad. It is that thing that we have that default. And a lot of the people who are getting furious at Theresa May or at whatever cuts on either side of the political spectrum, you're right, it's deflecting, taking responsibility ourselves. It's like, you can still be angry, but if you're not taking any action yourself, then how serious should your anger be taken?
Yeah, absolutely.
You can do both. Again, I'm not saying you shouldn't be angry, because there's some appalling stuff going on, but you can take action on your own side.
Exactly. And I think it's about just going a little bit deeper and doing a little bit more research so that you can understand it. Or you can, like, for example, to go back to the Trump thing in Texas, the heat. Yeah. In Texas, in Vegas, sorry, that we found footage of him basically saying it isn't guns that kill people, it's mental illness is the big problem. Yeah. And yet in February, he passed a bill that made it easier for mentally ill people to buy guns.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's just, I really enjoy getting deep into a subject and finding out these little hypocrisies and then presenting them back, because in a sense, they're more important than jokes.
Yeah.
Because that noise, to create that noise, fuck, from a crowd, particularly an English crowd, like, that's a really special noise, because English people are not really that easily shocked.
Yeah,
like, do you know what I mean? Or surprised. But that, I love that. I'm obsessed with small noises. I love that. It's like when you go to the cinema, it's one of my favourite things about being English. I've been to the cinema all over the world, and no one else does this. So when the trailers come out, you see the boom, boom, you know, da, 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 like that. And just at the end of it, you can always hear that noise. A few people go, oh, he's fucking shooting.
Yeah.
Like, and it's that lovely little tiny mutter.
Yeah.
Just in between the pole. Oh, fucking word. Yeah. I love it. It's my best noise.
It's the Britishness of not being able to hold that emotion in either. Because it's fine to not enjoy it. Do you have to share it in that moment?
Yeah, but we all do, don't we?
Just in case anyone's wondering.
Yeah, exactly.
I do not approve of that film. But, I mean, the great thing about using comedy to address some of these issues is it removes a little bit of the emotion involved.
Right.
And the emotion, I think, is the biggest issue in
I'm
go ahead. Yeah. In the gun conversation. Because the fact is, it's the emotional reaction of, no, we need our guns. It's like, well, to improve the gun laws, It doesn't mean getting rid of all guns.
Yeah.
There's numerous shades along that line of tightening up the kinds of guns, the kinds of security, the kinds of checks. It's not saying you have to give your gun up. It's saying maybe you shouldn't. Or you should have had to show some ID to buy it.
Yep.
Because of the laws that you don't have to show ID if it's a gun fair, if it's a private purchase, you don't have to show any kind of things like that. It's like, well, maybe you should. And maybe also, that's an acceptable thing.
And comedy, like, I take umbrage with that phrase that you can't teach people through comedy, because you sort of think, like, I know about the Rodney King beatings through Arizona Bay, through that Bill Hicks.
Right, yeah.
His bit about that is one of the best bits.
Yeah.
On that particular topic, or I know about, you know, I know a lot about gun control because of the bit that Chris Rock did, saying that bullets should be really expensive. They should be so expensive because if bullets cost a lot, there wouldn't be any innocent bystanders.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, and it's a really interesting, great joke that makes you go, oh, he's actually gone.
Yeah, like, that makes some sense.
So I kind of, But it's you certainly don't get answers from comedy, but what you do get is interesting provocation.
You bring up the discussion. I mean?
Yeah, completely.
And it's the problem is there's a certain kind of people, and it may be you and I, who are going to want to listen to talks or debates on this subject. Yes. But there's a certain kind of people who aren't, and it's why comedy is a great tool to bring those subjects into their life. Drama, I think, is a great tool. I was discussing this with Will Poulter, who's in the film Detroit.
Yes.
And there's some great documentaries about Detroit, about the LA riots, about the Detroit riots.
Yeah.
But there's not that many dramas about it. And there's only a certain kind of person who's going to go to the cinema to see a documentary, whereas a drama has a far broader audience. So it's similar with comedy. There's more people who go on a comedy night out than, oh, we're doing a lecture on Friday about gun law. I'm all right. Absolutely, cheers. Yeah. Whereas, oh, Russell Howard's in town. Like, fancy going to see
absolutely.
It. Yeah, I'm up for that.
Yeah.
And you can bring that debate in there.
Totally, yeah. And I think it's, you know, the further you get into comedy, it's a bit easier to... And like you were saying earlier, like, if you're, you know, an open spot, you're just starting out, it's pretty hard to kind of walk on stage and talk about things like that, because people are like, oh, mate, see you for an evening out. But a lot of people will go with you. You've just got to stick with it.
Yeah, and do it in an engaging manner. It's finding that line between... lecturing someone, because again,
but that is
no
exactly it,
that.
Exactly, and it's that thing of like it's. I think it sort of depends how you're raised as well, because someone like Danny Baker for me is one of the best people in the world, because he's so clever, he is so wise, he knows so many things on so many different areas, and he wears his knowledge so beautifully. It's like. It's just a pizza, and he's always offering slices.
Yeah,
you know, and it's so he'll tell you stuff, and you feel cleverer being around him.
Yeah,
he throws you tidbits, and I love people
and
like
that's
that.
That's the skill. You don't feel stupid around him.
Absolutely,
it's the important. I've always said this, but it's the role of Alan Davis on QI.
Yeah.
Alan Davis is incredibly intelligent.
Yeah,
he kind of plays the dummy. So when we're sitting at home going, I don't really know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
Someone then answers it and you get to go, he didn't know what they were talking about.
Yeah.
It's like, no, that's to get that education.
Absolutely.
So that we're not having to sit there going, I know what they mean, when we don't.
Yeah.
It's to get that further
I hate
engagement.
The sneer. And that's the problem with kind of, I've never, it's a weird thing of I'm more into deaf comedy jam than I am Radio 4 comedy.
Yeah.
Like, I hate that. laugh. I'm not into that. You know, when people go, oh, did you not know? When somebody tells me something and they tell it to me with passion, that will go in my head forever.
Yeah.
But if you sneer it at me, it just doesn't work. And that's just what I'm like. And, you know, my family are like that. My dad's like that. It's really good with his knowledge. And all my uncles, and they'll tell you stuff. And it's always done with a warmth. Bloody hell, do you know this? And it's never like, you know, do you hear or listen to this? It's bloody mad, this.
Yeah.
As opposed to, did you not know this?
Did you not know? Were you not aware?
Yeah, exactly.
Completely.
And I think it's just it's how you're raised and sort of your background. That I remember really sort of when I was a kid, all I did was play football. Why not? It's the best thing in the world to do. And there's still nothing better than being on the halfway line, gliding, seeing defenders peeling away. You're so in the moment.
Yeah.
Like have you ever tried mindfulness? Like the only time I can get to that moment of just being, I am here and I am thinking about nothing other than this moment is playing football. Like, I'm always thinking about something else.
Yeah.
But all I did when I was 15, I really got into like war poetry,
right?
At school, just loved it. And I like, you know, Wilfred Owen, kind of Rupert Brooke and all this kind of like in like the role that Rupert Brooke had in the war versus Wilfred Owen. I found it really interesting. And I would talk to my kind of mates about it, but in the play, oh, and all my mates were like me, just kind of dopey footballers.
Yeah,
I was like, yeah, it's really interesting. He kind of sort of taught. He basically is this poet, and he's just trying to convince young men not to throw their life away. It's really interesting.
Yeah,
and rather than, do you not know about Wilfred Owen? I mean, to be honest, I've had the shit kicked out of me if I'd have said that anyway.
Completely.
But I don't know. I think that it's that's what I'm like, and I love people who are like that.
And that is going to. Again, we're touching upon mainstream again. That is going to impact more people than the kind of a looking down your nose element of it. Because in general, all that appeals to is those who already know, not those who don't know. We do a thing on this podcast every few months after saying I don't drink much. Me and three mates, we sit in my mate's shed and we get drunk and we talk for 5 hours. And
wow.
There's a lot of nonsense,
but...
The fact is, there was an episode, for example, where we got onto a trans culture, which is a fascinating and evolving thing at the moment.
Yes.
And the fact, I genuinely think, three drunk Essex blokes, who all talk like this even more so when they're drunk, discussing how it's stupid that we're scared of this thing, is going to get through to more people than a lecture about, do you know what I mean? If we were all there going, of course, the nature of the human is this, and but of course we're going... Why does anyone give a shit about toilets? Again, it's like, is that... But I think it's going to reach more because it's more relatable.
It's also a lovely image of you lot. It's almost like a sort of really progressive version of the A-Team. That you're just in a shed.
In a shed just
having
talking.
Having a nat, and then you come out, we've learned stuff.
We've learned things.
But that's what I mean. I think... But to be honest, the way I write stand-up on my own. It's just my own thing. But when I write my TV show, I write it with four people now.
Are they people who you've been with throughout?
Three of them are, and I have a new person. Actually, two new people.
Yeah.
We just have really great discussions.
Yeah.
And sometimes I've got these kind of gaping black holes in my knowledge.
Mm.
You know. So, for example, this Kiri, who's one of the girls that works on the show, is really Kiri Pritchard McLean. She's really great.
Yeah.
And I just wrote a little joke, and it was about. I'll tell you what it was. And it was a show that it didn't make it in the show, but it was this driving instructor had said that Grand Theft Auto was really good at preparing you for driving, and it was just like a nonsense story. And you know, we were just writing jokes about it's going to be useful, isn't it? You know. 3-point turn and kill a prostitute. And she's like, can you not? She shouldn't be calling them a sex worker.
Yeah.
And we just had a really interesting discussion about that. And you're like, oh, yeah, okay, wow, of course.
Mm.
You know, and I really welcome that sort of, like, particularly when you're talking with, like, trans culture, like, about just learning how you have to be and treating people like human beings.
Exactly.
And what's really fascinating about it is that the mainstream, like, we've grown up on films where, like, how many times have you seen that as a joke in big Hollywood films where guy sleeps with a girl, turns out the girl's a guy, guy washes himself in the shower.
Yeah.
Like, that has been a staple part of mainstream comedy. And it's really fascinating that we're changing our ways.
Yeah.
You know, and I find it really odd that people are, but what's wrong with that? And you kind of go, because they're human beings.
Yeah.
Like, we can't do that. Things have to change.
And
you know?
Again, it's also the acceptance of being allowed to be wrong and discuss this.
Absolutely.
You're allowed to say things that are wrong. And we'll get onto social media because that was a fascinating discussion with Diane Abbott, and I think it's an interesting area. But I had Laurie Penny on the podcast who does a lot of feminist journalism, a great writer. And there was a thing I said in that one that was kind of wrong, and particularly with gender politics, it's a very quickly evolving thing. We're at a time where it's evolving faster than ever. So it's okay to be wrong as long as you're willing to discuss that and have those interactions.
Absolutely. And also there's lots of comedy in that, and there's lots of fascinating chats within that. Things don't all have to be militant, but it's like the conversation you're having with your pals. That's kind of such a real way of discussing it, because it's almost like, listen, I don't want to be an arsehole. What do I say? What are the things? Like, you know, that's kind of how we all feel.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, well, in that case, I mean, this isn't to make anything awkward or uncomfortable, but on exactly that topic, there was, I loved the chat with Diane Abbott and the addressing of the prejudice that women in particular come under on social media and in the world. But then in the second episode, again, I thought it was an amazing episode, but there was a couple of times that the joke was on sex workers and on that being, or more on it being a last option or a negative choice. Oh. And that was just something that jumped out to me. I know some people in that industry who they make really good money and they're really happy. Do you know what I mean? So not as a derogatory term, but as a...
But that's a very interesting point.
Yeah.
Because I know where you're talking, because it was about the fact that some students...
Yeah, had to go into the sex working industry.
And I was very careful in the language that I put, that I put some.
Yeah.
Like, that is not how... I think it was, that's not how everyone wants to get through education. So I put that in.
Yeah, no, that's great.
But maybe I didn't get it across enough because I accept that.
Yeah, because that was it. But again,
that was the thing, because the point I wanted to make is, like... not everyone wants to work in the sex industry to get through university, 100%. But some people do.
Yeah,
and you are right.
And that's exactly it, though. That's what struck me. But again, it's that excitement of these things to be discussed and debated, because there is huge areas of the sex industry that are horrific, and people are being exploited, and people don't want to be there and shouldn't be there. But there are also areas of people who are really proud of their sexuality and really comfortable and really kind of on top of that. So it's finding those balances and highlighting them.
I think it's a
fascinating subject. But on the subject of social media, I don't have politicians on the podcast,
right?
Because I don't particularly believe in our current political system. So I don't have allegiance either side, and I feel... it would be unfair to have one and not the other or whatever else. But what I loved about, like, I saw Diane Abbott was going to be the guest, and I was a little bit, all right, it's not really my kind of thing.
Yes.
But it was amazing, because she was there as a guest speaking about the horrible things that she's gone through and been attacked for. And it was it really highlighted what women have to go through. And again, there will be certain people who are now going, oh, it's tough for men too. And it's like, it can be tough for more than one person. Yeah. It's not to accept the hardships that women have to go through on social media and just are walking down the street on a Saturday night or a Friday night. To accept that isn't to take away from what anyone else goes through.
Exactly.
You can have apathy and for both. It's acceptable.
Yeah.
Or empathy, sorry.
Well, but it's weird, isn't it? Like, you know, the person I often think of with this is Josie Long.
Yeah.
She's such a, you know, she's a great comic. And like, but Josie... from 17 just used to get shit because, you know, she wanted to be a stand-up, and she started doing comedy, and that was all she did.
Yeah.
You know, and the level of abuse she got was mad.
And particularly at that point, she wasn't even political in her comedy at all.
Well, she was an open spot. She was starting. She was a 17-year-old girl who was, you know, into Vic and Bob and wanted to be a stand-up and just was dicking about, as we all are when we were kids. But it was like, I can't imagine what it'd be like now for, you know, younger people coming through, because I don't really go on social media because I love social media for, I like making things and then putting them on Facebook or YouTube and then letting them fly.
That
and
direct interaction with your fan base kind of thing. That, well, I just like direct access.
I've made a thing for you. Here it is.
Yeah.
But in terms of sort of the idea that, you know, if you were going on Mock the Week when you're a kid and then you get in and, you know, people are just smashing you. It must be awful. Mm. Like, I wouldn't be able to do that. When I started, it was like MySpace.
Yeah.
And that was kind of bad enough.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, the thing that's so sad about it all is that it just feels like Twitter... it just feels like the whole... like, there are words that I thought were extinct. It turns out they're not, and they've never been more prevalent. And that's the freaky thing, that you kind of... like, some of the things that are said about Diane Abbott were the kind of things that you only ever used to see on, you know, garage doors.
Yeah.
You know, in late night petrol stations.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of all there. And it's not just Twitter. It's like the Daily Mail online. There's always comments. And whatever you think of Diane Abbott politically, or anyone politically... like, when you're kind of, like, the level of slurs, like, you just have to have a cursory look at what people call her, and it's just like, I mean, and yet every day she still does her job. You have to have respect for somebody that does that, because she's 100%. Having rocks thrown at her on a daily basis.
Yeah.
You know, she's having death threats. People are threatening, threatening to throw acid in her face and rape her.
That's the thing that's tough, too, is people can say, oh, it's just the internet. Number one, it's not just the internet. That's going to a real person. But number two... we've had what happened to Joe Cox.
Completely,
so it's not just the internet. A death threat can't just be shaken off, or isn't going to be easy to just shake off when one of your colleagues has had a death threat that was then followed through on.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah.
it's horrific to say, oh, just ignore it. Just take it with a pinch of salt. It's like, no, but also terrifying.
But even if that hadn't happened, it's still a death threat. It's still a, you know, like, and it's just, I'll shake it off. Well, it's part of the job. It's like, it isn't fucking part of the job. Like, for any of us, just... It just feels like we're in a real cycle of violence in the world at the minute, but the UK as well. It's just very, very frightening.
Is that thing?
Do you ever think about just going somewhere where it's all just on a beach? You're in a little
constantly.
Hut. Yeah.
At every point, I have my last social media post planned, so it's changed numerous times of what it'll be. Sometimes it's a music video. Sometimes it's this, but always have in my head what it's going to be. Just I'll post that and then. I've got the advantage. All I need to do is have a shave.
Yes.
No one's going to know who the fuck I am. It's like I can avoid all attention from my fan, but just bang, gone.
How long does it take to grow that? Because it's pretty powerful.
I've no idea. I've had it a long time. Have so you? It's kind of, I've had it. The problem with this beard.
When did you get rid of it last?
So 2004 or 5.
Wow.
So that long. Yeah. But that's the problem with this beard is it's a hipster beard, but right. It wasn't. When I grew it,
yes.
But to say I had it before it was cool is the most hipster thing of the world. So by default, it's just it's a never-ending circle of ultimate hipsterism. It's painful and unpleasant, but you know I carry that burden.
But you carry it well. I'm very envious of men who can grow beards. I just can't.
Is it just not? It
doesn't happen.
It doesn't get there.
Bit gingery, and it's just like they never intertwine. They're just kind of long individual hairs that come out of their face.
I love the idea of that. It's a horrifying image.
Yeah, but like, you know, it's a bit like you know when you push Play-Doh.
Yeah,
and it just comes out in individual bits.
Just come out stranded and there. So I think we're done with social media there really, but it does just, it stuns me, as you said, the language and the thing I think that people get, or the phrase that people use that I think is a slight mistake is that social media has taken us back 20 years. I think social media has made us have to confront how far we hadn't come than anything.
That's a really beautiful way of putting it.
You know, it's just highlighted. Those people were there. They were just silent about it, I guess.
Well, I think...
Now they've got that anonymity and can express it without...
And also Brexit
responsibility.
Really brought that out as well. Yeah. It kind of gave a legitimacy to that kind of rabid nationalism.
Yeah.
And sort of like, you know, the facts that, you know... Like, my tour manager is Asian and... We were having a really interesting debate about this as we were traveling around the world. And he was just sort of saying that, you know, somebody called him something that he hadn't been called since he was a kid. And he just couldn't believe it. And it was in his hometown. And he was just like, what? You know, and I think that's what's sad, that it is, it doesn't just exist on the internet. It's kind of seeping onto the high street and it's being daubed on walls again. And I don't know, that's what saddens me, that there's got to be a way of fixing it all, because fundamentally we all get on, but it just feels like we've never been more divided and never been angrier, and you kind of go, how do we do that, how do we connect again? Because feel like the euphoria that we had at like something like the Olympics, when there was a real sort of togetherness in the country, or moments like the only ones I can think of is moments like sport, when kind of Mo Farah ran for us.
Yeah.
What an amazing moment of sort of multiculturalism that everybody was like, go on, yeah! And we, you know, he won for us and we were with him every step.
Yeah.
But other than sport, I can't really think what it is.
I couldn't relate more to that. I've grown up as a Millwall fan and I've been going to Millwall since I was 5 or 6. And Millwall and South London in particular has got a great history of racism and conflict in that way. And I remember when... We signed a winger called Etienne Vivier, who was a black guy and was really good. And seeing these people who don't like blacks suddenly being like, "Oh, but he's great! He's winning! Yeah. He's getting us up the league! He's doing great!" And then we had Stephen Reid and Tim and just all these different people, and it's like sport was what started to win a lot of people over there. Yeah. So it is a real thing. It's something that brings us together. But I think,
what is it other than that? That's the thing. Like that's kind of what I'd. Like, it's interesting because the Tories were attacked a few years ago for the idea of like trying to figure out the happiness of the nation. Do you remember that? We're going to teach happiness. And I kind of thought, I think that's something that we should be trying to do.
Yeah.
Because if you spend time, particularly if you spend time in Scandinavia, you kind of go, it feels like they've kind of got just it cracked happier. A bit. Yeah. I don't know what it is about us, but it just feels like that we're, I don't know, there's. there's something really sad about this land at the minute.
Yeah.
And it really upsets me because I love it and I love us and I just want it to be better. But yeah. It feels like it's just getting worse and there's a meanness to us.
I think the thing that needs to be highlighted is the problem is on both sides.
Absolutely.
And it's great that you mentioned a positive thing from the Tories there, because that's something that a lot of us don't want to accept. And I think part of the problem of the rise of racist attacks and slurs and things like that after Brexit was, and not wholly, I mentioned this online and it reminded me why I don't talk about complex subjects on social media that has a limit of 140 characters, because it's hard to get things across. But the fact that when Brexit happened, everyone, including me, admittedly, I didn't tweet about it, but I was thinking it and talking it to my mates, going, well, the majority of this country is racist.
Yeah.
Everyone that voted for Brexit is racist. And the fact is, they're not.
No.
A lot of them were scared, a lot of them were confused, a lot of them were protest votes. But everyone saying that the majority is racist then gave the racist minority the feeling, oh, I can be open about this. I can attack someone on a bus and everyone's on my side. We're now the majority. And I think that's what kind of... Well, there's both sides there.
But that's the legacy of it. And I think that's why people are so upset by Brexit, because, let's like you say, it gave a legitimacy to that very small amount of idiots. Because there are people that, you know, they voted for Brexit for you know, financial reasons, or for, you know, they thought they were going to get $350 million for the NHS, including some of my cousins who work in the NHS. They voted for it for that. You know, but there was a very small amount that... that were, you know, were out and out racists, and that they just, it just gave them power, and it was just sad. But it'll get better. It has to, you know.
And how? Again, this isn't to put the pressure on you, but genuinely, I don't think there's a single answer. But I think there's multiple things that come to that. It always annoyed me when Springsteen cancelled his tour in the states that had banned trans people. Using the toilet that they identify with, he cancelled that, and I did a tweet saying how great that was, and someone said, well, that's not going to solve it, is it? I was like, well, no, but if you're looking for one solution, you're never going to find it.
Yes.
But having a show that is mainstream but has people on, like the doctor that came on and talked about his book and spoke about the NHS. Now, Adam isn't a famous person.
Yes.
You've not had a famous person on, and it's and not to get self-referential and comparison-wise here, but one of the points when I started this podcast, I said to people all the time was, I enjoyed the Jonathan Aross show. It got big viewers, and he'd have four or five big A-listers every week.
Yes.
He would get the same amount of viewers if he had three or four big A-listers and one or two people that they've not heard of but have got important causes. And that's what I tried to do with the podcast, have Russell Brand as the first one, but soon after have Dr. Susie Gage talking about the misperceptions of recreational drugs and things like that. And that's what excited me about Adam on the show. And he happens to be a very engaging and witty and charismatic person, so that helps. But it was getting important points across of... As he put it brilliantly in when he said that everyone who is a doctor was essentially a straight-A student.
Yes.
So at some point in their career, they've gone, what do I want to do? Do I want to go to the stock markets or wherever else and make millions, or do I want to help people?
Exactly,
so when Gove or whoever is turning around and saying that the strikes are doctors being greedy, it's like, no, it's not. It's doctors... are wanting a level of equality, are wanting better compensation for the work they do. It's ludicrous to think anyone would choose that industry, particularly when there is private healthcare as an option as well,
completely,
where you can make a lot of money. So the NHS strikes can't be about greed. It's impossible.
Well, the interesting thing is that if the NHS does get privatised, which you could argue is what the NHS, what Hunt is trying to do, is trying to break it.
To run it down into the ground.
Privatise it. What will happen as a result of that? Two things will happen. You'll have had a shortage of doctors, because fewer and fewer people are going to go into the NHS.
Yeah.
And the other thing that will happen, the doctors that are there, they're going to be absolutely minted.
Yeah.
So if the NHS was privatised, doctors would be as well off as they are in America.
Yeah.
But the very fact that you have doctors marching against that, because they all sign up, because they all... believe in the concept of the NHS.
Yeah.
That they're all, irrespective of their backgrounds, they are drawn to it as a cause. They're they're soldiers that believe in it, you know, and they, you know, I mean, my girlfriend's a doctor, and you know, I've kind of seen firsthand that there isn't, like, it still blows my mind. And it's not just doctors, it blows my mind when you look at the wage packet of a doctor and there's a deduction for their car parking. They have to pay for, and you know, they have to pay like 20 quid a month for car parking, and that's nurses, that's anyone, because the NHS don't own the car parks, they're sold off. And it's just this thing of like, how the fuck is this happening? Like, it seems like such a fundamental, like the idea that, like, there's somebody in the hospital who isn't very well, and the doctor is having to pay to park to go and make that person better. Like, that, for me, that cuts through any political allegiance to say that's fucking idiocy.
Yeah.
That put the expert as close as possible to the ill people, let them drive, park for free, fix them, and then let them go home.
Yeah.
Like, but to penalise them for the audacity of taking their car to work is just phenomenal to me.
And often taking their car to work because the shifts they're working, there won't be public transport as an option at that point. Then, you know, and you're having to do that.
And gone are those days where you can write like doctor outside the house.
Yeah,
because we haven't got that.
Yeah, yeah. And it's kind of the arguments. The only time I'll ever see arguments against the NHS is when someone's saying, I waited for 4 hours, I waited for 5 hours, for 6 hours. It's like, well, what I always try and say to them, or want to say to them, is how much would you pay to not wait for 5 hours?
Yeah.
Because if it was private, you wouldn't be in there.
Yeah.
For whatever it is, let's say, would you pay 10 grand to not wait that 4 hours?
Yeah.
Because that's what privatisation is. That's having a bill and a fee and a cost on being seen and being looked at and this kind of thing. It's like, I'd take 4 or 5 hours over a 10 grand bill.
Yeah.
I'd wait.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the ideas that's been suggested is that people, once they've used the NHS, they should be given a bill. And not have to pay that bill, but a bill to show you just how much you've had spent on you.
Yeah.
And that would really make you think, wow, geez, like, you know, all that. And the other thing that's really interesting is that it's all part of the bigger problem, because people waiting over 12 hours on a trolley waiting for a bed has gone up 10,000% in the last 5 years. Mm-hmm. That's an astonishing, like, it's gone up.
That's insane.
10,000% in 5 years, waiting on a trolley for 12 hours. And the reason why that's gone up is for several reasons. One of the biggest things is it's the fact that we don't, it's to do with elderly care. So because it's very hard now to buy a house where you grew up, because house prices are going up, so you have to move away from your family to find somewhere to live. And then people get old, so our parents get old, or our grandparents get old, and we don't really look after old people in the way that we used to. So they're in old folks' homes, or they haven't got an old folks' home, but they're in that old house they always used to live in, but they're not really fit and able to look after themselves. But because their family has moved away from the original house, the doctors can't send the sick people who are blocking the beds back to their house because they can't look after themselves. And that's the kind of mess.
Yeah.
That's one facet of it. And it's just about, I often think, maybe a way of fixing it all, like they apparently, like, eight blokes own 48% of the wealth in the world. Yeah. We need to catfish some of them.
Yeah.
Like, do you know what I mean? It's that weird thing where you kind of go, if we could sort of, like, take all their money and fix things.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be amazing? Like just to kind of,
I'd love
it. Paul McKenna out there.
I'd love it if one of them turned around and went, you know what? I'm calling it a day. Yeah. I'm going to solve this. Because if I die and give my money to the world, then a lot of things will be sorted. And I don't think that my individual life is worth the millions of lives that I could change and save. It would be amazing if that happened.
I often think that, but I just, you know, if you had like, you know, tens of billions, just keep a billion for you. That's safe.
Yeah.
But then give the other 20 away.
And that's the thing that, again,
no one's taking your billion.
It's part of our society that we no longer have limits on what we want.
Yes.
We've built a society where we always want more. And we've been told that having more is the good thing.
Yes.
No one, as you said, gets to their limit and goes, Whew, I reckon I'm good now. But I reckon also, I've got a nice house. I've got my family. Yeah. We're sorted for life.
But that is also human nature, though. It's but that's about recalibrating ourselves because everyone kind of feels like that, don't they? Like,
yeah.
It sort of doesn't matter. Those, like, you have a house and you really like it, and then you think, oh, you know, we're always looking for the next big thing.
Yeah.
You know? But how do you change that?
Yeah, yeah, it's a tough one. But and just to wrap things up on the NHS, I think the problem is that the solution isn't to take money out, it's to put money in, right? That is the solution to incentivize more people to become doctors, to be doctors, to be nurses and porters and all the other really important roles. Like, let's not just highlight the doctors.
Absolutely.
Chains and chains. A friend of mine, it stunned me actually, he's a porter. Yeah, that's it, John. It was John. We've got a fan. But he was in our local papers because he's worked in the hospital for years, and a guy had a heart attack out the front and he gave him CPR and kept him alive until the doctors got there. And the stunning part there was the shock over the fact that he knew CPR, because he'd learned that on a course he'd taken himself on.
Right.
And no one else knew. And it's that craziness of there's so little funding and support that the porters and people there aren't even getting the training paid for them that they would like. He'd gone off and learned that himself. So it stunned me that this was a shock thing. And it stunned him. He was like, I was just at work and my job is in a hospital, so it shouldn't be a news story that I saved someone's life, but it was, because it is this shock thing there of the.
But the other thing as well, about, like you say, about putting money in, I agree with that, but also it does see it, like, it's not working as a system as well, like it's everything is about nuance, because it's not working, it doesn't need fixing, but there's so many things, like we spent 10 billion on a computer system that was never used in the NHS. That's such a fucking huge wastage.
Yeah.
But also, you've got these bizarre contracts where you have to buy a dishwasher from a certain firm, and those dishwashers are really expensive. Or like a microwave that costs like 50 quid versus you could get one for, you know, 10.99 or whatever, like for the hospital mess or whatever. Then there's all these weird contracts that could be unpicked. So it's almost like if you put some, like, a proper troubleshooter in there to kind of go, right, this is the thing. Yeah,
to streamline
it. Yeah. And I think a lot of doctors will back you up with that as well, because there's oceans of bureaucracy. So if you just keep, it's almost if you keep pumping money into it at the minute, that ain't going to fix it. But it needs money put in the right areas.
Yeah.
So it's useful for a porter to know CPR.
Yeah, like that's handy.
That is a tick.
Yeah.
But it's not useful to have the most expensive dishwasher when you could have just a cheap one. You know what I mean? Or it's just little things, like it almost needs someone with like really supersonic OCD to go in and just like with it, like John Richardson could go in and like really cut all the fat out of the NHS.
And that's the problem with so much council or government run stuff, is people just get into that's how we do it.
That's how we've always done it, rather than
questioning it. There's so much in that area where it's like, well, that's the company we've always used. It's like, are they the best company for it? Are they the cheapest? It's most affordable. But again, it comes down to it being a multiple solutions. And once again, it comes down to the fact that we can take responsibility ourselves by not clogging up the hospitals and A&Es every Saturday and Friday night because we're pissed hurting ourselves and falling over and hurting other people. And yeah, there's a lot there. I'll start to get towards at the end as we're approaching the hour mark. I'm a massive sissy, and the thing, literally every episode of Good News, I'd well up on the Good News part.
Yes.
And I was delighted to see the Good Deeds section in this having that exact same effect in episode one and episode two.
Yeah.
Just again, is that something that, I mean, you spoke about Scandinavia being a seemingly more happy society.
Yes.
Is that a conscious thing to go, well, look, it can't all just be doom and gloom.
Yeah.
We need the good news stories to come through as well. Because that seems to be almost the concept of good news, but now in the hour you've got that, and I also want to talk about the kids. But yeah, that's kind of, it does feel like something that's to bring people around a bit.
Yeah, well, that was the plan. I basically just thought it came from reading that thing about Spike Milligan, that he, you know, he's a bit of an absent dad, and he was just constantly writing scripts for the goons.
Yeah.
So he used to put little notes in his garden.
Yeah.
From the fairies, and his kids would have no idea that they were written by their dad, and they kind of opened them. It was such a lovely idea, and then it just came back from that. I was like, right, the plan is to try and put out as many lovely, you know, to get people to share things they've done or things that have happened to them,
yeah,
or encourage people to do really brilliant things, because again, that is such a, it's such a connective thing that people love hearing about moments like that.
Yeah,
we've got this guy on this week that basically put a tenner, loads of £10 notes in a little envelope, and he just put them around Cardiff, and he put a little note inside that said, "This tenner is for you. But the only thing is, you have to use this tenner for good."
Yeah.
So we did exactly that this week, that I just put loads of tenners and I put them all around Ladbroke Grove where we make the show.
Amazing.
And we left a little note saying, right, here's your tenner, but you have to use it for good.
Yeah.
So take some photos or have a video and we'll show the best things you do.
Yeah.
So, and I just really like that because...
What day did you put them out there? There's still going to be some out there when I'm leaving now, so I can.
You could still bag it. Yeah. Well, that's the funny thing, and it'd be a real. Imagine if people just blag it all.
Just one person collecting all of them. Cheers, Russell.
On Friday, I think. Yeah, so it should be there. But like, I don't know. I just like the idea of I love it when someone runs and catches the tube.
Yeah.
You know, as the doors are shut in.
Yeah.
I really love it when they make
it. You made it.
I don't like it when they don't.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of like, there's kind of a lot of comics who are like, yeah, fuck off. Like, they're really like, pleased that people don't make the tube. Yeah. Whereas I've always been a kind of make the tube kind of a guy. So stories like that. And particularly, I don't know, I just really like little moments of beauty and little tiny or big things that just cheer you up.
It's weird. I've got... just mentioning the trains there, at my train station in Essex, Stamfordley Hope, it's got a long platform, and we often have shorter trains, and people don't pay attention to how many carriages are there, and one of the seats on the platform is way past where the train stops, and I'm someone to have my headphones in, eyes down, not engaging, but that's the one thing that I regularly do, is I'll know there's only four carriages, and they're sitting all the way down there, and I'll start to call them down early because I know that otherwise they're going to have to run for it and maybe not get on it. And and again, it's a nice feeling. I'll still have my headphones in and not engage with them once they're on the train.
Yeah.
But it is that nice feeling of finding those small things to go, it doesn't put me out in any way. Yeah.
And it just puts a little bit of loveliness around, you know, I really like people, and people can be amazing and they can do beautiful things. Like if you're feeling down, just watch footage of deaf people having these kind of hearing aids put in and they can hear for the first time.
Yeah.
And it's just the best because it's such a human, like that is a human brain that has invented a thing that is helping another person.
Yeah.
And they hear their loved one talk for the first time. And it's impossible not to cry and feel proud to be a human being. And that's what I love about being alive. Like you have those moments where you're like, fuck me, I'm so glad that we can do stuff like that, you know.
The guy in his shed who had the 3D printer,
what a human
made
being.
Made a simple design for artificial hands that are more functional for free, also put that design out there for free so people with their own printers can print them off, and does it all off donations, and again the looks on the faces of these kids who previously had an NHS or whatever else arm that was completely unfunctional and unusable. And
but it's exactly what you're getting at as well, is that particularly more than ever we live in a real refillable celebrity world where you know it's a lot easier to kind of just plonk on the latest thing that Kim Kardashian's done or the latest thing that Brooklyn Beckham's done, and you can just refill. Once you've set all these things up, you just refill it and here's a little twist on the thing you already know, here's a little twist. But we as human beings will never not be interested in someone that comes from nowhere like that guy, and you hear his story and everyone wants to know it. So there's a guy called Kenton Lee who I'm fascinated. No one knows who he is, but he made shoes that grow with children's feet. So it's like there's a little kind of hook on them.
So
they kind of gradually get bigger so that kids in Africa don't get kind of parasites in their feet.
That's
so
amazing.
They can have the one pair of shoes all the way through their life.
Yeah.
I absolutely know that, imagine if we lived in a world where instead of the Daily Mail sort of sidebar of shame.
Yeah.
If that was filled with people like that from all around the world, of which there are many, and their own little story, the world would be better, because yeah. you'd hear about that and you'd be inspired by that, and you'd or you'd kind of want to do that, or you'd just be cheered up by that. But it's so much better for us rather than this sort of like just slew of hate and yeah. flesh. I think that's a really important thing that any of us lucky enough to be kind of in the media, that you have to show these other people that are ultimately far more interesting.
Yeah.
Because what we do, like particularly my TV show at the minute, it's reality TV.
Yeah.
And reality TV is being horrified by Trump's reaction to, being upset by what Trump said at the UN.
Yeah.
And then the next day, seeing people here. They're seeing people here for the first time because of this device that's been made, what it is.
It's I think we do need to recalibrate the way we plug in, because it's so easy now to just do the outrage part.
Yeah.
And not do the engaging and beautiful part. The fact is, we do have the internet and social media, so we can plug in to all these people and we can do something nice on a far grander scale than we could have ever, or even just spread, as you said, spread that good feeling on a far grander scale than ever before. Yet it's easier to just be angry at Trump and just I did a thing on, I was having a, I have love hate with social media, and I had a little period where I was down on it, and on my Twitter for a good 3 weeks every tweet I did started with "I like."
Yeah.
It was just something I like, and it was one of them was literally "I like James Acaster as a person and performer,"
because
he was just, I'd watched him or I'd listened to him or something. I was like, he's just adorable and positive and lovely. And I did that, and it was good. It didn't have the effect I hoped, because I realised it wasn't my Twitter stream that was bringing me down.
Yeah.
It was delving into the broader stream and going, oh, there's so much misery and ugliness. So it didn't, selfishly, it didn't have the change I was hoping. It was positive still, and it was a good thing. But I did kind of go, all right, if I want to solve my issue, I just need to come off social media rather than try and change around. But again, I think
we clone James Acaster.
Yeah, that'd be a perfect
solution. Lots of little, I often think that, loads of little Jameses.
I've just finished reading his book, and I highly recommend
it. Oh, really? The Scrapes?
It's The Scrapes,
What's it called?
It's all about his scrapes and the issues the problems he's had in life. And it just makes me want to just, if I wish there was a social media where you can just go on and you just watch whatever James is up to at the moment.
and just
be entertained by that. That would make me happier. We can't do this podcast and not talk about the fact you've just done like the biggest tour ever, kind of. Like you've just done amazing. a huge world tour.
Yes.
10 nights at the Royal Albert Hall. Which is a new record that was previously held by Sinatra and Barry Manilow, right? I think did 8 nights. So you've taken over there. You've just done the biggest comedy show ever in China, I think it was.
Yes.
So, I mean, how's all that been? Comedy's a tough one for translating around the world. Even just to America, it can be a tough one. So how's that been, kind of going out there and just, it working?
It was great. It was really good fun. Like, gigging in China was just so funny.
Because you had a couple of pieces translated into Mandarin, right? And that's kind of, that blew up a lot in China, honestly, on social media, right?
Sorry, I'm just making a tea. Sorry, everyone.
It's all right.
I had this, there was a story I did ages ago about, there was a boy that I met. Hang on a second. There was a boy I met who basically defeated cancer.
There's this beautiful little story, and I told it, and it kind of went a bit weird this summer. It kind of went mad, and it got translated into Mandarin and went mental. So I was kind of walking around Shanghai. I was only there for 4 days, and people were kind of recognizing me.
Wow.
And they were kind of, because some Chinese celebrity had put it on their Twitter, their Chinese Twitter, and it had gone mad.
And we're so isolated from that world.
It was so strange.
That's as big a world as America and the UK and everything.
Yeah. Well, people were poking me.
Amazing.
And sort of, you know, just kind of go, oh, you and the kid with the dick. And you're like, whoa, 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 whoa. So it's kind of a
push. What have you heard?
Totally. It was a bit weird. And then, we just did this gig. And it wasn't, it was like, there was 1,000 people. And in Shanghai, and the government there were to check whether I said, you know, whether I basically, you know, deviated from the script, and I did, and it was all fine. It was just really, it was just a normal gig, and then we kind of left. But that was like the whole tour, really. The whole thing was just, you know, I gigged in Scandinavia for the first time, and that was brilliant. And you sort of realise, you go, yeah, of course we've got loads in common with someone in Stockholm.
Yeah.
Of course you can do a gig there. And then gigging in America. I mean, it's all on a far smaller scale than what I do in England. But it's still like, a thing of like, you're doing like a 500-seater in Stockholm. And people are there. And so you get to be in a cool city and you get to do a gig and it's really great. And you see different things. Or you're in Finland. I was in Finland and I saw a guy catch a pigeon in his hand, you know, just that was trying to eat his chips and throw it away, and you know, there was all these kind of weird fun things, and it was a bit like that. So it was a real, it was a perfect way of seeing places, really, because you sort of get to travel around and then chat about it at night
and getting to do it all,
and just the fact that there's people, like, it's such a buzz that, like, in when it first starts happening, and you must know this, that first thing when you know, when you travel somewhere, there's people waiting for you and you get to do your thing and they kind of know what it's going to be, but then you're a better version of what they wanted. It's the best.
It's
because because you've spent years getting to that point. And then suddenly when people get, like, they hear about you and then they want to see you, you're like, well, this is going to be great because I've been waiting 10 years.
I've been waiting to see you guys for ages.
Completely.
And now I'm here and you want me here.
Absolutely, And I've rehearsed this date for 10 years.
I think I've told this story before on the podcast, but I always remember when we were touring America for the first time and we got to Ames, Iowa, and the promoter was like, look, we've only sold 50 tickets. And I was genuinely like, dude, before this tour was booked, I didn't know what Ames, Iowa was. Yet there's 50 people here who know what we are. That's amazing. It might have been 20 or 30. I can't remember. It was a low number. And it was like, this is amazing. And it was one of our best gigs. Because we were literally like, just thank you for being here. And particularly when it's a gig, particularly with music, the smaller the crowd, the more self-conscious everyone's going to feel, the less they want to go mental. So it's like, you have to go even harder to go, thank you for not leaving.
Because
this is an uncomfortable scenario for you. Because you've come out to a gig and you're in a 200 capacity room with like 30, 40 people. It's like, that means all the more that you're here and you're sticking around.
We had the same. I did a gig in Boston and there was like 300 people and it was great. And I think that's it. Is it kind of doesn't really matter if you love performing. It's just great. That's the thing. And it's just, and it's such a kick to kind of do gigs in Australia or China or Singapore or America or Norway. You know, it's just like, God. And you often think of, it sort of goes back to how you're raised as well, I think. Like, the idea, you sort of think of, like, little you in the back of your mum and dad's car, you know, kind of singing along to Madonna. You know, and going to, like, the seaside and that. And then suddenly you're kind of on stage at the Sydney Opera House. It's just mind-blowing. You know, and the cool thing about the Sydney Opera House gig is that I got my tour manager, Kumar, to come on stage. And I got the whole crowd to chant his name.
Amazing.
It was beautiful. And, you know, so it was a real, that my main memory of the tour is just me and my mate Kumar, who also happens to be my tour manager, just having this lovely trip around the world. And also in a time of real turmoil and change.
Yeah.
So it was a really fascinating time to be, you know, being away from the UK during the election and, you know, things like Grenfell and the terror attack in Manchester. So really seismic things were happening. And all the while we were travelling around, we were doing gigs and the world was changing. And that's kind of how it feels at the minute, you know. And particularly being a comic, the world, because it's changing at such a pace and in such a different way, that you've always got stuff to talk about and react to. You know?
Connecting in all those different places makes it feel like a far smaller world. You realise how it is all connected.
Completely,
and we are all related. One of the important things, as anyone who's as busy as you are, I think, is keeping it enjoyable and interesting. And regardless of how well you're doing, if you're doing the same thing every night, it can get taxing, it can get exhausting, it's still a job. No matter how much other people from the outside look and go, oh, that must be amazing, it's still work and it's still a job. And one of the things that I think, as soon as I saw it, I thought, that's done, it works perfectly as entertainment, but that's done for yourself as much as anything, is the talking to all the kids around the world as part of the show. Because it just seems like you're having so much fun there. And that's a bit of work. You've got some work to do, but it's going into schools, and it was kind of two kids at a time each time, and you had a list of subjects to discuss, and then each episode it'll be, now we're going to discuss war, and it'll be kids in Swansea and Bristol and Denmark and wherever else, Australia and all these places. How was that to just
brilliant
talk to these kids about serious issues?
Well, that was it. So all the while we were doing this tour, we would just have a day in a school in Singapore, or we'd have like a day in a school in Toronto. It was such a laugh, like,
amazing.
And we got so much footage, and just it was so funny. You just forget how, and sometimes really informative, and sometimes just wild. And I loved it.
It is the variation. There's from going from serious subjects that are being taken incredibly lightly by kids to the two girls who I think are just absolutely insane.
The girls in Swansea.
Excited about having cream eggs in their mouth, I think, at one point.
Yeah.
But then to the two lads who've been quite laddie and geezerish, and then one just goes, can we stop talking about war now? I want to get onto another subject. And it was done in a kind of kid, I'm bored of this subject way, but it was also quite a beautiful thing to be like, can we get on to something that's not war and terror and misery kind of
there's
thing?
There's one of my favourite bits from nowhere. We were chatting to this girl in Bristol, and she was so, just this really cute little girl, and she just went, and it's, we weren't even talking about, I said, what jobs do you think you're important? She went, I think it's really important to be a fireman. I don't want to be a fireman, but I think it's important to be a fireman because they're going in there and they're running in fires and they're trying to put them out. And they should get paid more than footballers because at the end of the day, footballers are just having fun. And it was such a brilliant way. She wasn't trying to be funny. There's nothing better. Like, she was, and it was almost the perfect punchline and point. But she's like, and I just was cracking up. And then it's that weird thing when you forget, when you laugh at a kid, they get a bit freaked out,
right?
They're like, what? And you're trying to say, no, that's great.
Yeah.
And that was the real thing that I learned, that you kind of, you can't laugh at children because they get freaked out.
It makes them step back a
completely
bit
and
go into themselves, right?
But she was so cool, that girl,
I love it. I love the removal of the acceptance that we've built up to certain things throughout our lives. There's so much in our life that we're just like, oh, that's normal.
Yeah.
When it's like, it's not. And footballers versus firemen, ways is one. I still maintain that, why do we accept Madame Two Swords as a normal thing?
Yes. Mate, I'm
it's
exactly
a big
with
room
you.
Where
fucking
made
right.
Wax versions
and they
of
look
humans.
Fuck all like
and
them.
People queue up for hours, and we go there and go, look at the wax version of the person. That's mental.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's not. It's totally.
It's a major tourist attraction in London. You are completely
terrifying.
Right.
What, I don't understand it at all.
There's
imagine
another
pitching it now if it didn't exist. Some guy going on Dragon's Den. Oh, what are you going to do? Well, I'm going to get all this wax.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to carve it into the shape of famous people.
Yeah, is it going to look
security?
Like
security?
Oh, no.
Nothing like
it. It'll be passable.
It's terrifying.
Fucking right.
But there's tons that
there's one.
I think that's the beauty of talking to children, because they will call us out on that bullshit.
Yeah,
whereas
we're
like, well, no, that's just normal. It's like, no, mate.
Yeah.
That's dead weird.
There's one in Blackpool as well. Have you seen that? But
no,
it's the sister of, I think it's called like Barry Two Swords or something like that. Like, genuinely.
Yeah, brilliant.
But it's like a knockoff version of Madame Two Swords.
Excellent.
So it's like sort of Jack Duckworth.
Amazing.
Like, just people like that. So it's really like lo-fi. But stinks of chip, fat and fag ash.
I love it. Of course it does. Like, as it should do.
Such a good point though, man. Every time, because weirdly I travel past it quite a lot, and I often think that you walk past, there is always a huge queue.
Yeah.
And there's such a big queue that they have people, and friends of mine in the past, comedians, had jobs where they had to entertain the queues because the queues were so big.
Yeah.
They would be walking around entertaining the crowd. So it's an industry that's never going away.
How damaging is that, though? You're a real person.
Yeah.
And your job is the warm-up
for
pieces of wax.
Yes.
You're warming them up. They're like, I hope we get past this real human who's an entertainer, but so we can get to the big bits of wax.
Have you ever
quickly
been?
I haven't.
Why would you go? I've never been.
I don't
either.
Know. I think I must have as a kid, actually, because there's a photo of me and my brother with not Mr. T. Yes. So I can only assume it's a wax version, unless we met someone that was just dressed up as Mr. T and was a bit static. But yeah, it's a bizarre
one. You are so
one.
Right, though. It's when you kind of, you sort of realise that these things are just absurd. These like Seymour Mace had a lovely joke about that. He's a brilliant Geordie comic. And he was just sort of saying, the first time a dog, first time you pick up a dog shit, they must be so confused. Yeah. Like, and it is that beautiful thing. We just take that for granted. That's what we do. But the first time that dog does that, and then you pick it up, they must be like, whoa.
What?
Because we don't do that. Like if a horse shits in the street, the dog must be looking at you that first time going, go on. What, so it's just mine?
This must be like Christmas for you.
So you're only picking up mine. Okay.
Right, it's very specific.
But there's loads. It's a really interesting thing. There's so much stand-up in that about, and kids have got such a perfect way of looking at stuff.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. I've only ever done stand-up for kids once, and I just couldn't do it because being self-deprecating doesn't work in front of five-year-olds because all the stories are the prince gets the girl and the princess is beautiful and the ugly people die and the fatty falls over and that's what it is, whereas you know that like adult humor is about you looking like a Burke or you know, so you're stood there kind of deflecting and being rubbish and they're like, this guy's a prick, why is he glad of all this failure?
Completely. But it's bizarre how much our society is still built around that and accepts that. I remember, I think it was a comedian talking, I can't think who now, but was talking about the disgracefulness of Susan Boyle, of that phenomenon, because it was like the emotion that we all felt because this unappealing person could sing.
Like,
we should feel guilty there, that we're all looking going, this is going to be disgusting. Oh my God, it's beautiful. It's like, why were we assuming it was going to be shit? Because she doesn't look like a pop star or whatever.
That is it.
But that's one of the great, again, I remember watching that and welling up and it was a beautiful thing. It's like, it's not beautiful. It's beautiful in the constraints of our society. It's not beautiful if you step outside of that because all of the beauty comes from the fact, look at that piece of shit. Actually, there's talent and it's like, that's ugly as anything. But yeah, anyway, I'll wrap things up now. Where can people keep up to date on everything? What the
telly show?
Russell Howard Hour is on Sky and Now TV.
Yeah, Thursdays at 10 o'clock. That is it.
Amazing. And where can and you're on social media as just as Russell Howard?
I think so. Yeah, I don't really know.
It's probably something like that. It's easy to find. People have got Google, right?
Just put Russell Howard and find me.
You'll find it. It's easy. Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
I really enjoyed that.
It's
been
a
pleasure.
Lovely chat. Thank you.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pick's Discretion Pieces.
That was episode 173 with Russell Howard. How lovely was he? I was so pleased to have him on. We could have, as you can see, we could have talked for hours and hours and hours, but we reined it in and left it there. I do recommend his Russell Howard Hour. I think it's a great show. It's a great mixture of shows he's done in the past and just, as I say in this episode, I think it could be an important show. It's not the solution, but it's part of a broader solution of discussing important things in accessible manners. But yeah, there's that. I should mention that on November 25th, we have the last We Are Lizards club night of 2017 at the book club. It'll be me, regulars Chris and Stu from the Hardcore Listening podcast and the Drunkcast, DJ Destruction, Discotheque Credits, and we're joined by Hugo of the Maccabees, previous Distraction Pieces podcast guest, and the legend Lindy Layton. So come along to that November 25th. If you want to get on the, if you've seen on the night, I often post a video or Instagram story of the queue because it tends to be going all the way around the corner and that always excites me, even though it happens regularly. So if you want to get on the queue jump list, send your names to info@thetrashsociety.com. Yeah, that's where you head for that. Also, I mean, that email address is run by Stu from Hardcore Listing and the Drunk Cast. So if you want to sling some abuse in there, you're welcome. Sling your names and a bit of abuse, then go ahead and do that. I'll be back next week with a guest I haven't announced yet, but it's a very, very good one. And then I'll be back with just every week with loads of good guests. There's a lot going on, trust. Thank you very much for tuning in.
This has been the Distraction Pieces Podcast, episode 173. Oh, I stuttered right at the end. I'd got through the bulk of this outro without stuttering, and then big old stutter. Ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.